Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the 1 Hour Editorial Review. 1 Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. 1 Hour is an education service with public interest out in Marriott, George Gordon. Now, the 1 Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the 1 Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the 1 Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's Tribes Today. When we come back. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of the entire population with a top tax rate of only 7%. Now, today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of this income tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. By the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels. Now, this year, the average American family had to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us? You know, this income tax and Social Security tax violate 3 of the Ten Commandments and 8 statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. Now, the income tax and Social Security tax are also 2 criminal activities. The income tax is the 2nd plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the 8th plank. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? If you'd like more information about tax and status, just call the law school at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, that general law CD package is a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, our school on tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and then send an email request for your free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're going through the 10 tribes of Israel. A fellow by the name of Stephen Collins, S-T-E-V-E-N, Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S, his latest book called Israel's Tribes Today, and it's a 250-page book that identifies the location of all of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. So far, we've covered Ephraim, Great Britain, Manasseh, the United States of America, Reuben is in France, Zebulun is Holland, Asher is in South Africa. We broke off last time, we're talking about Asher, being a tribe of miners. And we could identify them in the time of Christ as mining up in Great Britain. They were associated with and living in the tribe of Ephraim. And they broke away from the tribe of Ephraim in a war in South Africa about 1899. They were associated closely with the Dutch. It was the Dutch that colonized down in South Africa and went through a thing down there they called the Boer War. Now, the Union of South Africa was long a part of the British Empire, dominated by the tribe of Ephraim. Other Ephraimite nations founded by England, such as Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, have been content to stay British without any rebellious war for independence. However, the 13 original colonies of the United States and the Union of South Africa fought wars against England to gain independence, and this argues that neither nation was essentially Ephraimite in nature. And we've seen that the United States of America was the tribe of Manasseh, and South Africa's war against the colonial British indicates that it was mostly composed of another tribe of Israel as well. In Genesis 28, verses 13 and 14, God made this promise to Jacob. Remember, Jacob now is the father of these 12 Israelite tribes, 13 when you count in Manasseh. He said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, and your seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. This prophecy guaranteed that the seed, that is the children, the offspring of Jacob, including all of the tribes of Israel, would eventually spread out around the world so that they would be found in all directions from the ancient land of Palestine. This prophecy indicates that some of Jacob's descendants must have spread to the location south of the Old Kingdom of Israel. I might point out here that the Jews now, a lot of times people, they'll write me a letter when I get through this series, I'll get a number of emails, and they'll say, you fool, you blind, that's Jewish. There's nothing Jewish about this. The Jews only comprised 1/12 of this family. They're just one tribe. There's another 12 tribes besides the Jews. Remember, there's 13 tribes we discovered here already. When Joseph broke into 2 tribes, you know, you had 11 and 2 is 13. So you have 13 nations around the world here, 13 groups of people around the world that are living in homelands like South Africa or Israel or Great Britain, the United States. And the Jews only comprise about 12th of the family. Whereas when you go to church, they tell you that these Jews over here are the house of Israel. And it works like this. You see, all Californians are Americans, but not all Americans are Californians. And while it's correct for Californians to call themselves Americans, it would be incorrect for the Californians to claim that they are only the Americans and nobody else is. And the same thing is true here with the Israelites. It is true that the Jews are all Hebrews and that the Jews are all Israelites. But it's incorrect for them to say that all of the Jews comprise all of the tribes of Israel in the same way that it's incorrect for the Californians to claim that they represent all of the Americans. They only represent 1/12 of the family. And because the Christians couldn't find or figure out where all of these tribes of Israel were located, well, until now, or until the 20th century, the first guy, I think, that put his finger on the pulse of it was a guy named J.H. Allen, who wrote a book called Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright back in 1907. Now, Stephen Collins comes along and says, well, now, not only can we identify these tribes as being Israelite, we can identify with specificity where these tribes are located. And while it is true, there are probably Jews or Jewish descendants in all of these countries. I'm sure that South Africa is full of Jews, but they don't represent all of the white people in South Africa any more than the Jews represent all of the Americans. There's quite a contingent of Jews here in the United States. But there's also quite a contingent of Danes and Dutch and English. And as we'll see here, French. Remember, the French now are from France. So if you've had it in your mind that all of these Israelites are Jews, that's incorrect. Some Israelites are Jews. Most Israelites are not. All Californians are Americans, but most Americans are not Californians. Most Israelites are not Jews. Now notice also the chronology of the directions listed in this prophecy. The first direction named for the spread of the Israelites was west. And in the time of the Phoenician Empire, led by Kings David and Solomon, the Israelites dramatically spread to the west, founding colonies in Carthage, Spain, the British Isles, and North America. Carthage continued this westward expansion. The next direction mentioned was east. The next major migration of Israelites was indeed to the east. Assyria took many captive Israelites eastward and resettled them in modern Iraq and Iran. Other Israelites who had fled to the Black Sea region spread as far eastward as India and western China. This eastward expansion led to the Parthian and Scythian empires. The next direction listed in the prophecy was north, and when Parthia fell, millions of Parthian refugees, along with their Scythian kinsmen, migrated northward through the Caucasus Mountains around the Black Sea and into Europe. Some Germanic tribes migrated as far north as Scandinavia and Iceland. The final direction listed in the prophecy was south. This direction had been almost ignored in the previous Israelite migrations, and when the British Empire expanded, three major Israelite nations were founded south of the equator. These nations were Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. The nation of South Africa is due south of the land of ancient Canaan. The prophecy of Genesis 28:14 accurately foretold the nature and the order of the major Israelite migrations in history. The biblical clue about the latter-day Asherites points to South Africa, and it is the nation most identified with the mining of gold, gemstones, and precious metals. All were royal delights to kings of any nation and historical period. All right, and I might add that the tribes now of Asher, which they also settled in Rhodesia, the British, you know, had taken over Rhodesia and South Africa. Those two countries are now in national captivity. Now, when you go to the two penal clause chapters, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, here in the latter times, the end times, just before the second coming of the Messiah, you find that the nations of Israel go into national captivity. Two of them have already been taken into national captivity, and specifically in Deuteronomy 28, it says that the stranger that is within your gates shall rise up high above you and bring you down very low. The South Africans have been brought down very low by the strangers within their gates. So have the Rhodesians. In fact, the Rhodesian farmers have just all but been thrown out. I think there's just a couple of dozen of them left, and they're on their way up. Now, the next one here is called the tribe of Issachar. And so right down on your list, number 6, Issachar, spelled I-S-S-A-C-H-A-R. Some of you people may be descendants from the tribe of Issachar. What nation in the world could that be today? Wouldn't it be interesting to note that you're descended from the French, and so you're a descendant of Reuben, or you're Dutch, and so you're a descendant of Zebulun. Or maybe you're from South Africa, and you're a descendant of Asher. Well, here comes Issachar. In the ancient world, a nation that was under tribute had limited self-rule while under the dominance of a stronger nation. In ancient days, this tribute was generally an annual payment of gold or the concession of territory. The nation of Finland has long been in the condition of living in a buffer zone between stronger competing nations. After centuries of Swedish rule, the 1700s and 1800s saw Finland caught between Russia and Sweden, who fought for sovereignty over Finland. Finland's sovereignty has been compromised ever since. From 1899 to 1905, Russia dominated Finland. And the Encyclopedia Britannica tells us that Russian officials and the Russian language were foisted on Finland wherever possible, and in 1903, the Russian governor was invested with dictatorial powers. Now, the Finns were literally under tribute as the Tsar fixed an annual contribution. That contribution fixed on Finland was paid annually. And in World War I, the Britannica notes that Finland escaped invasion, but Finland's liberties were restricted. This describes a nation under tribute. World War I also saw the Finns volunteering for service in the armies of both Germany and Russia, their two burdens. Some independence was restored in 1917, but in 1918, Finland concluded a treaty which made her Germany's ally and vassal. Finland was now under tribute to its other burden. Between the world wars, Finland became increasingly identified as a Scandinavian nation, but the Russians again launched an attack on Finland as World War II began. The Finns made a heroic resistance against the Russians, but had to sign a treaty ceding territory and dominance to Russia. When Germany attacked Russia in 1941, Finland briefly allied itself with Germany before signing an armistice with both Great Britain and Russia in 1944. At the end of World War II, Finland had to pay certain amounts of finished industrial goods, more tribute to the Russians. Now, Finland has been a buffer state between stronger nations for most of their history and has literally been under tribute, and at times, its current tribute is Finland's neutralist foreign policy for which it receives an accommodative relationship with its bigger neighbors. Now, since Finland is located in a buffer zone between the Western and Eastern blocs, a neutralist position is a safe one for Finland. The Finnish capital, Helsinki, even gave its name to the Helsinki Accords, an East-West agreement signed in the neutralist nation of Finland. Finland has found peace and prosperity by couching down between two burdens. This condition is so uniquely Finnish that it has even given birth to the term Finlandization. Finland accepts some limitations on its sovereignty, but it currently enjoys a milder form of tribute than it has borne in recent history. Finland fulfills the prophecy about Issachar's descendants in our modern world. It is also likely that at least some of the Baltic people of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are part of the tribute of Issachar. This small Baltic nation and these small Baltic nations with Finland have been couched down between two burdens, Russia and Germany. And Russia and Germany have historically competed for control of these nations. The Estonian language and the Livonian dialect of Latvia confirm historic ties to Finland, as both languages are linked to the Finnish family of languages. All right, that's about all there is. Issachar will put down Finland. Let's take a look at the tribe of Naphtali, spelled N-A-P-H-T-A-L-I, Naphtali. Now, when you look here, I'm going to go back here to Issachar for a second. Issachar's tribal emblem is a burro or a donkey which has two burdens strapped to its back, one hanging on each side. Now there's a prophecy in Genesis 49 verses 14 and 15. And it tells us that Issachar is a strong ass couching down between two burdens. And he saw that the rest was good and that the land it was pleasant, and bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant unto tribute. So to identify this nation, we had to look for a nation in Europe, including Scandinavia, which has a tradition of being quasi-independent and under tribute, is located between two stronger nations, Germany and Russia. And Issachar was a son of Jacob and Leah, and the tribe originally lived near the Sea of Galilee. And after their migration into Asia, they were one of many related Saki tribes of the Scythians. And there's one possible identification of them among the Saki tribes. And during the 2nd century BC, the tribe known as the Takari migrated with the Massagetae and other Saki tribes out of Central Asia and into new homelands in the eastern part of the Parthian Empire. In Numbers chapter 26, verse 23, one of Issachar's clans was named after Tola, the son of Issachar, and it's possible that the Scythian tribal name, Tochari, is a composite word composed of the first syllable from the word Tola and the last syllable from the word Issachar. Since Tola was a clan of Issachar, the two words would have been linked together often in their usage. Specific evidence of the Issacharites passing through Russia on their way to Europe is found in the name Tula, T-U-L-A, which has been for many centuries a Russian city and region just south of Moscow. This name indicates the Tola, T-O-L-A, clan of Issachar migrated through that region and took a more northerly route into Europe and than did most of the other Caucasian tribes. And plotting a course on a map from the Caucasus region past Tula would lead one directly to Finland and Scandinavia. That Thule, T-H-U-L-E, Greenland was settled by Scandinavians indicates that the clan of Tola was involved in this settlement as well. So I just wanted to point out to you here that Issachar is a strong ass couching down between two burdens, and that's on their heraldry emblems. Now, when you talk about heraldry, heraldry is that shield that you have. The Gordon clan has a shield, and on the shield are two boar hogs with their front legs up on top of the shield. And there's your heraldry. Every clan has a shield with some kind of a picture on it. So when you look at the shield of England, you'll see that they've got a lion or that they've got a bull on it. In the United States, our heraldry is that eagle clutching 13 arrows in one claw and an olive branch in the other claw. That's called your heraldry signs. Well, each one of these nations, each one of these tribes of Israel has one of these emblems or heraldry signs. And guess what France is? It's a shield that has waves on it, which, remember, Reuben is as unstable as water, and so there's the water on it. In the Dutch shield, in the Dutch heraldry, they've got a ship on their shield. And every one of these tribes has a shield or heraldry that identifies them with Genesis chapter 49. Each one of these tribes has a characteristic that has been emblazoned upon their own heraldry. All right, Issachar. In the ancient world, that's Naphtali. I finished Issachar. In the tribe of Naphtali, a hind let loose. Naphtali was a son of Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid. Naphtali's inheritance was in the northern portion of Canaan, and Assyria carried the entire tribe captive into Asia years before the fall of Samaria. You read that in 2 Kings 15, verse 29. And they're one of the easiest tribes to locate in Asia, as their tribal name maintained virtually unchanged. And as described earlier in this book, they were the Ephlalite or Naphtalite Huns. They were also called White Huns, as they were fair-skinned, Caucasian, or Semitic in race. The striking similarity between the Israelites, called Naphtalites, and the Asian Ephthalites, E-P-H-T-H-A-L-I-T-E-S, is obvious. The fact that this tribe went into captivity as a whole unit, rather than in piecemeal clans, likely explains why they are still known by their original Israelite tribal name as late as the 6th century A.D. The Encyclopedia Britannica tells us that before their arrival in the region of the Old Parthian Empire, the Ephthalites were originally a tribe of the great Yuchi living to the north of the Great Wall of China. Historian George Rawlinson places the migration of the Yuchi tribes into Parthia during the 2nd century BC. These Yuchi tribes were known collectively as the Saki, spelled S-A-C-A-E, a testimony that they were the sons of Isaac. When Parthia fell, the Ephthalites did not join the Parthian-Scythian migration toward Europe. They fought many battles against the Sasagian Persians, who had driven out the Parthians and even ruled their own kingdom in the region of Afghanistan and West India. It is known that they had a heavily armored cavalry corps, as had the Parthians. Their capital, called Sakala, was also preserved or has preserved the name of their forefather Isaac. However, in the 6th century AD, they were defeated and they disappeared from Asia. The Encyclopedia Britannica states that the Ephthalites' defeat completed the ruin of the white race of the plains from the Oxus to the Don Rivers. The Ephthalites likely migrated toward Europe where the rest of Asia's white tribes had previously relocated. Their disappearance from Asia confirms that they migrated out of that continent, and many Caucasian tribes migrated into Europe as the white race of the plains exited Asia over several centuries. Now, while the Naphtalites are one of the easiest tribes to trace in the ancient world, their identity in the modern world is more challenging. In Genesis 49, verse 21, gives us only this small clue regarding the location of Naphtali in the latter times, or the latter days. It says, quote, Naphtali is a hind let loose. He giveth goodly words. Not much of a clue, Genesis 49, 21. Now, how do we make sense out of this clue? A hind is a female deer, and the words let loose implies a condition of being active in the wild. Female deer are most active in the wild during the rutting season when they're in heat. This implies that the Naphtalites, particularly the females, will be identified with sensuality in the latter days. Sweden has this reputation of being a sexually permissive, liberated society. Blonde Swedish actresses have been prominent sex goddesses in the movie industry, contributing to the image that blondes have more fun. Now, while this analysis fits Sweden, we need more evidence than this to have a firm identification of modern Naphtali. The phrase, giveth goodly words, can literally mean give beautiful sayings or speeches. Is Sweden identified with the giving of beautiful speeches or pleasing pronouncements of some kind? Well, yes, indeed they are. Sweden sponsors famous speeches or pronouncements which are eagerly awaited by the world media every year. They're called the Nobel Prizes. And Sweden issues the annual Nobel Prizes, which are beautiful speeches or pleasing pronouncements given to noteworthy achievers in a variety of fields. These awards are world famous and convey great prestige on the recipients. No other nation of Europe is so identified with the practice of making internationally famous awards to the rest of the world on an annual basis. The limited clues of biblical prophecy indicate that Sweden is the latter-day Naphtali. All right, so Naphtali, then we'll put Sweden over here. So here's Sweden. Now, so far we've identified Ephraim as Great Britain, Manasseh the United States, Reuben is France, Zebulun is Holland, Asher is South Africa, Issachar is Finland, Naphtali is Sweden. I've got to give you a reminder right here, so let's take our break right here as we come up to the tribe of Benjamin. Next, Benjamin, the youngest son of Jacob, Israel. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that are cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Talking about the 12 tribes of Israel, actually there are 13 of those tribes. I mentioned to you earlier that the Jews represent 1/12 of the family. They're a very prominent tribe in the family. In fact, at one time they had their own nation back in ancient times. It was called the House of Judah, as distinguished from the House of Israel, which had two separate dynasties of kings. And you see that the Jews are often at war with the Israelites, which isn't too uncommon. The Israelites are often at war with individual tribes of the tribes of Israel. As nations grow large, as it turns out, the United States has never had a war with Canada, but it's not out of the question. You know, brothers get into beefs once in a while. And we fought two wars with the British, but I want you to notice that in World War I and World War II, when the British were attacked by the Germans, that it was the Americans and the Australians and New Zealanders and the other Israelite nations that sided in with the British against the Germans, which, as we're going to find out, the Germans are one of the tribes of Israel. It's really, in reality, when you look at this, it's really a family feud. And the thing that we're all feuding about is who's going to control the world? Who is going to run the world? That's what the feuding is all about. Now, there's a couple of three Gentile players in the game. The Chinese want to rule the world, the Japanese, the Russians. Those are the three major contenders that are vying for world dominance. In the Western world, the French and the British and the Americans have been vying with the Germans. And it's always the Americans, the British, and the French that are allied against the Germans. Do you notice that? Hell, the Germans are one of the tribes of Israel. We'll see that as we're progressing along. And it all has to do with money. It's nothing personal against you Germans. It's just money. It's nothing personal. But somebody's going to rule the world. And you know, from our perspective, we're not going to let the world be ruled from Berlin or Paris. And so it's the Americans and the Britons who are the chief possessors of the birthright. And we have been guarding world dominance for about 200 to 300 years, starting around the Spanish Armada, is when Britain really started to get their sea legs. And through the 16th and 17th centuries, they had a big bitch on their hands, you know, with the French. And so the French and the British were duking it out, you know, until about, 1750 or so. And then it was pretty much the British had control. And then the Americans came on the scene. And then the Americans said, okay, well, we're gonna duke it out with the British. And so the French, seeing an opportunity to help us duke it out with their arch enemies, the English, which in reality is just two brothers fighting over who's going to control North America. So the Americans come in, that 13th tribe, and we kick the British out. And the British said, well, we're not going to sit still with that. And we had to have a second round in 1812. Then when we got rid of that, we fought against the Indians and against the French. And finally, we bought the French out. Remember the Louisiana Purchase back in 1803? It was just a business transaction. Hey, you know, we're going to buy you out, split and run. So we bought the French out, and we took over the operation here in North America by ourselves. Now, the Canadians to the north, you know, you can't tell a Canadian from an American when they move down here to the States. And I want to point out that it's not just the Canucks moving down here. 600,000 Americans a year go up to Canada. Did you know that? So about 500,000 of us are migrating up to Canada, and I don't know how many Canadians come down here to the United States, but you run into them every now and again down here. And, you know, they just kind of assimilate down here. And I moved up to Canada. I bought a place up in Vanderhoof, British Columbia, back in 1961, I think it was. And I was going to move up to Canada. And I just kind of fit right in there. I really like those Canadians. They're just super nice guys, hardworking people up there in the outback, you know. And so we got up there, but I got cold feet. I happened to be in the Vanderhoof Hotel one day, and I was looking across the street, and there was some Mounties over there. And there was, I don't know, two or three drunken Indians down there. You know, the Indians get a little drunk once in a while, and they're just having a good time on the weekend. And those Mounties just beat those Indians to a pulp right out there in broad daylight. And I said, well, now that's something new. We do that in the States, but we do it in private. You know, we arrest them out on the street with a smile on their face, and then we take them into jail and beat the hell out of them. Not those Canadians. God, those Mounties up there are just kind of nasty. They just beat them to a pulp right out there in broad daylight, and while the whites were just kind of walking by. And I looked at that, and I said, you know, this doesn't look too kosher to me. Then there was a second thing that bothered me. I was out talking to a farmer, and I don't know how it came up, but the subject of the Fourth Amendment came up, and he was talking about how the Mounties just come out and break your door down or come into your house and search. They normally don't break your door down. They just knock on the door and say, we're here to search. And so the good Canadians, they just open the door and let them in. And I said, you mean without a warrant? And the guy looked at me like, a what? See, we Americans, we're kind of solicitous over this thing of free speech and a warrant before you come in and search, because we kind of like our privacy. But I noticed that the Canadians, they're not offended at all. Not offended at all. They don't have any regard for free speech, as you can see by the hate crimes legislation enacted in Canada. By, you know, we Americans down here, you know, at least those conservative Americans down here just cringe at the thought that somebody would control our speech. Outlaw certain topics. You can't talk about homosexuality, or you can't talk, you know, about Jews and the Holocaust. And then there was a second element that came in there, that search warrant. Thank God, that just really blew my mind. You mean the police just come out and search your house? Yeah. I said, boy, that's a new one on me. So I decided Canada's not my cup of tea. So I pulled up and I left Canada, and I'm not sorry that I did, although, you know, we Canadians and Americans get along so well, we don't even have a guarded border. What would we need guards on our border for? See how that works? That's what brothers are like. You know, it's like, hey, Bob, come on over. Let's have dinner and so on. Now, of course, the Canadians complain that the Americans down here, we dominate the Canadian culture and we dominate the Canadian economy. Well, yeah, that's about right. But, hey, you Canadians, don't feel bad. We dominate everybody in the world. And that's what that birthright was all about. We just dominate everybody in the world. Economically, we're just in control. And, of course, we have not handled that very well, and we're about to have it all stripped away from us. So I was over in Reno not too long ago, and there happened to be an Indian in our class, American Indian. And he mentioned to me during the class, he said, you know, you whites came over here and stole our land. And I said, hey, listen, nothing personal, partner, but you know, you had the ground and we wanted it, so we just took it. Just business. And he complained a little bit more, and he said, you know, you Americans, you whites have not treated us fair. You made treaties with us, and then you broke the treaties. And I said, yes, sir, that's true. Yes, sir, we made the contracts with you, and then we took your property, and we didn't pay you for it. And that's very normal. We Israelites are well known for that. Well, we're well known for our lying, our stealing, and our cheating. But I consoled this Noel guy. He's in his 70s, nice old Indian guy. And I consoled him a little bit, and I said, now you can rest assured that our God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has not missed our lying, stealing, and cheating, and he's about to pay us back for that. Because what proceeds out of the mouth of a man cannot return again, so says our God in Numbers chapter 30. And he said, now what I'm going to do here is I'm going to punish you guys. And in Deuteronomy 28, he said, here's what I'm going to do to you. So if you Americans there want to know, here's what's coming, you just go read Deuteronomy 28, you Manassites, and here's what God is going to do to you. Now, you might want to read into that, you Aussies and New Zealanders and Canadians, because you're into this game also. You got your little bit of share. I mean, we got the lion's share coming, but you got a little bit of your share coming. And there's a real nasty bunch of guys, and I think it's the Chinese, a real nasty bunch of guys, and they said they're going to come over here, and they're going to bash your little baby's brains out on a wall in your presence so that you can watch it being done. Then they're going to rape your women and then put you to the sword. How do you like that? He said, they're a wicked and an evil bunch that I'm going to cut loose on you guys. And that's because of all of your own sins, all of your own crimes and criminal behavior. Just thought I'd share that with you a little bit. Now, during World War II, a lot of Israelites got burned pretty badly. The Germans got burned, the French got burned, the British got burned, but the Americans, Australians, and New Zealanders came out of it pretty well. We never suffered very much, but our turn's coming up. Now, here's another tribe called Benjamin. So let's write him down. He's number 8, Benjamin. I'm going to write this down myself so I can keep track of this. Benjamin equals. Who do you think the Benjaminites are? So if you're any Swedes out there, you know you come from Naphtali. If you're a Finn, not too many Finns that I've run across here in the States, but once in a while, we had a Finnish lady live next door to us on 1728 Street. She was a Finnish lady. It's about the only one I've ever heard of, or that I ever met or knew. All right, we're up to Benjamin now, number 8, Benjamin. Benjamin was the youngest son of Jacob and Rachel, and the only full brother of Joseph. This tribe was almost exterminated in an ancient Israelite civil war in which the Benjaminites were sufficiently fearless and foolhardy to fight all of the other tribes all at once. This senseless civil war is discussed in Judges 19 through 21. The Benjaminites were fierce warriors, and all the Benjaminites were outnumbered 400,000 to 26,700. They won the first two battles as they routed the combined forces of the other tribes. Let me repeat that. The Benjaminites were so mean, so nasty, so fierce, that 26,700 of them routed 400,000 from the other tribes. Now that's a mean bunch. And you don't see that until you get down to the Middle Ages, where we see the Vikings coming out of the north and dominating the British and the just scaring the living hell out of everybody in Europe all the way down to Africa. They're called the Vikings. Well, anyway, they won the first two battles as they routed the combined forces of the other tribes. Judges 20, verses 21 through 25 records that the Benjaminites decimated the armies of the other tribes, killing 40,000 of them. The Israelite tribes had to fast and then obtain God's help to defeat the Benjaminites. At the end of this needless war, the entire tribe of Benjamin was reduced to 600 men. 600. So you Benjaminites out there almost got obliterated. But you know God, you know dummy, he sits and says, well, wait a minute, if we're going to have 12 tribes, we've got to save a little seed stock. So he kept 600 bulls so they could rebuild the tribe. And so the tribe's been rebuilt. And from that time on, Benjamin's population has always lagged far behind the other tribes. And they were the smallest tribe in Israel at the time. One of their members, Saul, King Saul, was made the first king of Israel, as we read in 1 Samuel 9, verse 21. When the tribes of Israel divided into the two kingdoms of Israel and Judah, Benjamin remained with the tribe of Judah, 1 Kings 12, verse 21. And after Judah went into captivity, a contingent of the Benjaminites returned with the Jews to rebuild the temple and to rebuild Jerusalem. You'll read that in Ezra 1, verse 5, and Nehemiah 11, verses 3 and 4. Herbert Hanney's book, European and Other Race Origins, included ancient records that representatives of the Benjaminites spread over the whole length and breadth of Asia Minor. The Bible indicates that Israelites were living in Asia Minor during the apostolic era. The book of 1 Peter begins by addressing God's people, marginal reading in the King James Version, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. The term Galatia indicated the same people as the Gauls of Europe, and the Bible records that one famous Benjaminite, Saul of Tarsus, was born in Asia Minor, so there is biblical evidence that Benjaminites lived in Asia Minor in ancient times. Saul, you know, the Apostle Paul, Saul of Tarsus was the individual who later became the Apostle Paul, as we see in Acts 9, verse 11, Acts 13, verse 9, and Romans 11, verse 1. Now again, Herbert Hanney links the Benjaminites to the modern nation of Norway, a conclusion with which this book concurs. The biblical clue for Benjamin's location in the modern world today is limited, but it's indicative. Genesis 49, verse 27 tells us or gives us this clue. It says, Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. Did you hear that? Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. God, if that doesn't describe the Vikings, I don't know what does. Wolves are indigenous to northern climates, indicating that Benjamin's latter-day territory will be in the northern latitudes. The only European nation in a northern latitude not yet identified as one of the tribes of Israel is Norway. And by the process of elimination, Norway would seem to constitute modern Benjamin. Norway is a lightly populated nation, consistent with Benjamin historically having a very small population among the Israelite tribes. Norway has traditionally had excellent relations with the British and the Americans, which one would expect of the descendants of Benjamin, the tribe genetically closest to the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Since Iceland was populated by Viking Norsemen, the Icelandic people are also likely of the tribe of Benjamin. The phase or phrase about devouring the prey and dividing the spoil do not describe Norwegians today, but they very aptly describe Norway's Viking heritage. The Vikings were known for preying wolf-like on all the other nations of Europe from bases in their northern coastlands. This parallels ancient times. Even as Benjamin warred against all the other tribes of Israel in a bloody civil war back in biblical times, the Vikings also fought against all of the other tribes of Israel who had migrated to the various locations in Europe. The Vikings raided the British Isles in Western Europe and the Mediterranean coastlands of Europe as well. The Vikings also raided into the settled in the modern Ukraine and Western Russia. National Geographic magazine made this comment about their eastern forays. By the early 9th century, they, the Vikings, were navigating the Volga and the Dnieper to reach the merchants of the Abbasid Caliphate, and by 860 AD, they attacked Constantinople. Now, the National Geographic also notes the prominence of wolves, the symbol in Genesis 49, verse 27, for Benjamin. In Viking mythology and art, historically, other Scandinavian people besides the ancient Norwegians comprised the Vikings. However, the Viking heritage seems most closely identified with Norway. There is another curious connection between ancient Benjamin and modern Norway, and it was noted above that when the ancient Israelite tribes divided into a northern kingdom of Israel and a southern kingdom of Judah, that Benjamin stayed in Judah, the southern tribe. The Benjaminites had a closer affinity with the tribe of Judah than did the other tribes of Israel, who severed their ties to Judah. The Norwegians brokered the Oslo Accords in 1993. So you have the Helsinki Accords, and then you have the Oslo Accords of 1993, a famous peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The willingness of Norway to involve itself in the Israeli peace process is, in fact, consistent with what one would expect of modern Benjamin, which was once part of the Jewish kingdom of Judah. So based on the biblical clues about Benjamin's location in the latter days, Norway best fulfills the prophecy of Genesis 49 about the tribe of Benjamin. Curiously, while Joseph's tribes were fated to become the most popular tribes of Israel, Joseph's brother Benjamin became the Israelite tribe with the smallest population. Therefore, we should also expect modern Benjamin to be a nation with a small population and a very rich heritage answering to modern Norway today. So I'll put that down there. Benjamin equals Norway. I'm starting to run out of time, so before I get started on the next outfit here, the tribe of Dan, which is a pretty colorful tribe. These Danites over here have quite a bit of history behind them. We find them here in the United States. I'll put Dan down here, and I'll give you a little clue. The country is named after Dan, and you can identify it as Denmark. In fact, over there, they call it Danmark, the Mark of Dan. This guy is pretty interesting. As you look all over the maps of Europe, you're going to see the name of Dan everywhere. You're going to see it in Russia, all over Europe. And it's just this little tribe and a little country called Denmark has had that much influence over the geography of Europe. Remember, we are reviewing Israel's tribes today. Where are they located in the world today? And what are the clues in the Bible that identify these people today? Stephen Collins has answered that question. And it's in a book called Israel's Tribes Today. You can order a copy of it from the publisher called Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. And the zip code is 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Their webpage is Bible Blessings. It's all one word, just BibleBlessings.net. BibleBlessings.net. I have had nothing but good words about this fellow Collins. He's a nice guy. I've talked to him two or three times on the telephone. I said, hey, I got your book. I'd like to review it. He said, well, go ahead and review it if you would. And we would appreciate that because when I review a book, of course, typically I say, this is a pretty good book. You ought to buy one. And that's what I'm doing here today. I'm selling Stephen Collins' book. Now, I don't get anything out of that. I'm not financially involved in it. But as a historian and as a journalist, when I run across something that is unique, unusual, you know, as old Paul Harvey used to say, let me tell you the rest of the story. And he had that cute little segment for 5 minutes on where he'd tell a story. And it's something that's unusual, something that we wouldn't expect, something that we didn't know. And that's what we do here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, is to try to reveal little-known pieces of truth or historical fact or political intrigue or economic chicanery that's going on that maybe you hadn't heard of. Or we will report on publications like the International Forecaster or some other book along that line. So remember, this is Collins' book, Israel's Tribes Today. All right, I'm about out of time, so let me give you a final reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the U.S. and worldwide over the Internet. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. All right, we got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.